Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. Vice President Mike Pence is in Nebraska today to survey flood damage after rivers breached at least a dozen levees in the Midwest. Heavy rain and snow melt have caused rivers and creeks to swell across the region, including in Iowa. So let's go now to the town of Hornick. It's about 30 miles southeast of Sioux City. Residents returned home yesterday after they were evacuated for several days. We have the mayor of Hornick, Scott Mitchell, on the line now. Mayor, thanks for taking the time. We appreciate it. About 250 people live in town, and it sounds like the flooding affected just about everybody there.
Yes, we have widespread damage from just a little bit of water, you know, say just a little bit of damage to having, you know, your basic pump full of water. At one point in time on Friday, we lost all access to town because all the roads around it had water running over them.
Mayor, tell me about your last 24 hours. I'm sure they were difficult and eventful. I understand you were on an ATV riding around town to survey the damage. What have you been up to?
I try to get around town and see the residents, and we're still, hopefully by the end of today, we'll have a lot of the water gone around town. We're still trying to pump that out. Our sewer system is up and running, but the lift pumps are not keeping up with it yet, so we're still advising the residents not to use the water and sewer. I would hope by the end of today that we can allow them to use the sewer system, but until the point that it's keeping up, we can't. And then the volunteers is just unreal. You cannot believe how many people have come to little town of Hornick and come to help us.
What are they doing for you?
Anything from helping people empty their basements, moral support, you know, everything from cleaning up to just being there to tell them their presence or sorry. You know, it's pretty amazing what I could say yesterday, and I honestly believe this. I think we had more volunteers here in town than we had residents.
Coming from all over the state of Iowa, sounds like.
Coming from all over the Midwest.
Yeah. You've been praised by your governor, Kim Reynolds, for proactively evacuating the town on Thursday morning before the floodwaters hit. How did you know that you needed to make that decision? Because you live in an area that is prone to flooding every year.
We developed a flood action plan, and I looked at that on Wednesday prior to our meeting, and I had decided that once the levees was topped or breached, whichever one it was, once we had water that could get to town, that I would evacuate town because I figured it would take us 6 to 8 hours to evacuate town. It actually took us two. When we called in help to evacuate town, we had more fire departments here than you could ever imagine to help us get people out of town. And something that assisted with that is prior to that day, Wednesday, we went door to door, and we let all the residents know what was going on with the West Fork of the Little Sioux. So residents kind of had a little bit idea that we could have had some flooding.
You're a small town.
Yes, we are.
I wonder if people who live there will have the means to rebuild, and if you're worried they might move on elsewhere after this.
I'm really worried about that. You know, we have a lot of people. We have a lot of people in this town that don't make a lot of money. And we have a lot of people in town that are going to have hard to come back from this. But we're going to do everything we can if they decide to help them rebuild. But I also understand if they don't want to, but I don't want to lose residents in this town.
What would that mean if you did?
It would break my heart. It would really, really break my heart because that would mean that we did everything we can and we just can't get them to stay. I mean, we everybody in this town, we're not a community, we're a family. And unless you come from a small town or you live in a small town and you have that feeling, you don't understand it. But, you know, I can walk out my front door of my house because I live in this town and I can see my neighbor. And we wave and we talk to each other. You know, people walk by in the big cities all day long by people and they don't talk to each other. Here in a small town like this, you talk to everybody walking up down the street.
You're, in a way, you're fortunate because the waters have mostly receded from what you're telling me. I wonder if you have a message for people across the Midwest who are still underwater right now.
Good luck. know that I'm praying for you, and keep your head up, because it will get better, and there will people that come and help you. You're not in this alone.
And how are you doing, and how's your home?
My home, I come from a family of nine. I'm a very proud person. It took a lot of talking for my brothers and my sisters to allow me to let them go and try to clean up my house. I know that I have a lot of family members there today working on it, because I can't worry about my place. I have to worry about everybody else here in town. And that's, I made that choice when I left my house, and I stick to it. I stick to that now. So,
Scott Mitchell, mayor of Hornick, Iowa, thanks for speaking with us, and best of luck to you and to the people of your town.
Thank you very much. I appreciate your time.
Well, this week, Russia is celebrating an anniversary that most of the rest of the world is condemning. It was 5 years ago this week that Russia annexed Crimea away from Ukraine, a move Kiev considers an illegal land grab. President Putin marked the anniversary in the Black Sea Peninsula yesterday. The U.S. and other countries have responded with economic sanctions. And joining us now from Moscow is the BBC's Steve Rosenberg. Hi, Steve.
Hello there, Jeremy.
So, you know, we don't often see moments when the map of the world changes, but if you look at Google Maps now, you see a dotted line between Crimea and neighboring Ukraine. But if you're in Russia and you look at it, that line is solid. There's no doubt in Moscow that it rules Crimea now, is there?
Yeah, absolutely. And certainly if you listen to the messages coming out of Russian state television, all the state TV channels, if you read the state-controlled newspapers, that is definitely the message that Moscow is putting out, that 5 years ago, Crimea sailed back to the home port. That is the phrase you hear very often here. You don't hear the word annexation. Mm-hmm. Moscow maintains that Crimea historically was part of Russia, and that due to a democratic vote in a democratic referendum 5 years ago, Crimea returned home to Russia. Now, of course, that is not the view of the international community. The referendum was not recognized internationally and only happened after Russian special forces came into the peninsula.
Why did Russia want it in the first place? Is it more clear now, 5 years on, why it was so important for them to have control of Crimea?
I think there are several reasons. First of all, historically, I think many people believe that its rightful place was as part of the Russian Federation. But I think there was a feeling 5 years ago when Ukraine had its revolution, its pro-Western revolution, that there was a danger that a pro-Western government in Kiev could actually affect the situation in Crimea, where Russia's Black Sea Fleet is based. And I think the Russians were terrified in that situation. The Black Sea Fleet could be forced to leave Crimea. Now, you often hear Russian politicians saying that Crimea rejoining Russia protected the Crimean people from Ukrainian nationalists, has put Russia back on the map as a strong power. I think geopolitics here is the key, that there was a fear in Moscow that that revolution in Ukraine could have a negative effect on Russia's geopolitical position.
What about the sanctions? There have been sanctions put on Russian officials from the U.S., Canada, the EU. Have they made any difference following the annexation of Crimea?
It's interesting. I was watching Russian state TV's flagship news review program this week, and the anchor said, actually, sanctions have made us stronger. We don't fear Western sanctions. And I suddenly thought, well, if that is the case, why is it that you so often hear Russian officials complaining about Western sanctions? And every time there's a new round of sanctions, either from the United States or from the European Union, Russian officials come out and they complain, they say it's unfair. And I would say sanctions have had an effect on the Russian economy. I think there was a survey done by Bloomberg the end of last year, which suggested that, in fact, sanctions had knocked 6% off Russian GDP. And there's no doubt that Russians are feeling an economic downturn. Real incomes have fallen 5 years in a row here. It is becoming harder for Russians to make ends meet. And part of the cause of that is the economic pain, I think, caused by sanctions.
And yet Putin remains very popular in Russia, right?
Well, he remains he retains a degree of popularity, I would say. Now, if you compare that to 5 years ago when all of this was happening and Russia was annexing the Crimean Peninsula, he was super popular then. He was seen as a Russian leader, almost czar-like, who was the gatherer of lands lost by Moscow. He's not that popular now. You know, Russians have other concerns. They talked about the economic concerns. A recent change to the pension system has hit Russians hard, too. You get a feeling of social unrest bubbling away. And, you know, Russians traditionally blame everyone else except the president. They blame local officials or they blame the government. They very rarely blame the president. But now you start to hear, well, you know, Putin's been in power as prime minister and president for 20 years. He should have done something better to make our lives better. You're starting to hear that now. And I didn't hear that before.
That's the BBC's Steve Rosenberg joining us from Moscow. Steve, thank you.
You're very welcome.
Our next guest is one of the most prominent intellectuals in France, but his new book is about America. It's called The Empire and the Five Kings, America's Abdication and the Fate of the World. The five kings are other powers, Russia, China, Turkey, Iran, and Sunni Arabs. Bernard-Henri Lévy joins us now from Paris. Welcome to Here and Now. And you start this book by focusing on the Kurds, U.S. allies, that you say the U.S. has abandoned, that the U.S. is stepping back from its leadership role in the world.
It's more than stepping back. It's a betrayal. The Kurds were our best allies in the area. They were our boots on the ground. They were a living rampart of flesh and blood against barbarity, preventing terrorisms. And when the job was finished, we told them, go to hell. The behavior of President Trump when he decided to withdraw from Kurdistan, from Syria, and from the Iraqi Kurdistan was just disgusting. It's a moral failure, and it is a political mistake.
And why do you think it happened?
It happened because America now reasons only on short term. There is no strategical aim. This is the thesis of my book. For example, in the relationship with the Chinese, what I demonstrate in the book is not that Mr. Trump does not act. Of course he acts. He tries to make a deal, as he says. But on one side, you have people, the Chinese, who are thinking on centuries. The Chinese have a long, long-range way of thinking. America thinks, I don't know, next month, next quarterly, at the maximum next year in these negotiations about tariff and so on and so on. Regarding the Russian, it is the same. Putin has a strategy. Trump has a tactic. Erdogan has a strategy, which is to rebuild the Ottoman Empire. We have a tactic, which is to crush down his currency. And so on. The Iranians, Iran. Mr. Trump pretends that Iran is the worst enemy, the most dangerous for America and for the West. But when the occasion arises, he delivers on a silver plate to the mullah of Iran, what they want most.
Which is what?
Which is Damascus and Baghdad, which is the Shia arc. Of course, we have the sanctions, but they have Baghdad and they have Damascus and they have the strong alliance with Putin. So we are in a situation when our leader of the free world, Donald Trump, plays muscles, but the real strength is on the side, alas, 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 of the five kings, Chinese, Arabs, Iranians, Ottomans, Turks, and Russians.
Well, you say to that point that the United States is a power, but one that never entirely sought its empire's glory. It is an empire, if you will, but a recalcitrant one whose nobility has always been to balk at imperialism. Why do you think that is, that the United States holds the title, basically, of empire, but it never really wanted to be that way?
America has been an empire in very precise circumstances when there was only you to save Europe from suicide in 1914, when there was only you to defeat Nazism in 1942-3-4, when there was only you to defeat communism, which was another fascism, the fall of the Berlin Wall, and from time to time to spread democracy and to crush the third fascism, which is the Islamist one. What I love in America is that generally this imperialism is rather uninterested. It is not imperialism in order to stay or to occupy your territory and so on and so on. But now we are facing something new, which is no empire at all. The only empire of America is the empire of Mr. Zuckerberg. It's the empire of the Facebook and Twitter and the social networks and so on. But this is not serious. And this does not change anything in the concrete life of all those who all over the world consider America as the shining city upon the hill.
So you're joining us from Paris today, and I wonder whether you think that Europe has dropped the ball. Why can't European nations step up in the way that you would like America to right now?
Sometimes Europe did that. For example, in Libya, it was President Sarkozy who took the lead, and President Obama exerted the leadership from behind. Why not? Europe is lazy. Europe was accustomed to the American security umbrella, and it will take time for Europe to take its responsibility. The metaphor I use in my book is the metaphor of Aeneas, the hero of Virgil, the man who goes from Troy to Europe. Now, Aeneas went from Europe to America 2 centuries ago to build America. Maybe today Aeneas has to go back to Europe, but it will take time. Do you know, I speak about Aeneas. Does one of your listeners know why there is 3 quotes of Virgil on a banknote of $1? First of all,
right.
Do they know why? If they don't know, I will come back at the mic. I will tell the story.
I want to ask you about your criticism in this book of both President Obama and President Trump. Starting with President Obama, you criticize him for drawing a red line with Bashar al-Assad in Syria over the use of chemical weapons in 2013, but then not acting. Why was that such a turning point for you?
Because America is a special country. Because America has the belief that it is exceptional. Barack Obama this day did break provisionally, forever, I don't know, with this exceptionalism. He said at the end of the day, okay, America is just another country. We have no special responsibility. Because what he did this day was to say to Bashar al-Assad, the worst butcher today on earth, he told him, beware, my dear friend, if you cross the red line of the use of chemical weapons, you will be punished. Then Bashar al-Assad crossed the line, and what happened? Mr. Obama went to make a little tour in the garden of the White House, and at the end of the tour, he said, nothing will happen. This, for America, was a loss of credibility, which I never saw, and it was maybe, I hope not, but it might be a U-turn in the deep metaphysical vocation of this great country, which is America.
Now, when it comes to President Trump, you write that no matter how often the 45th president of the United States expresses his love for Israel, reasserts his solidarity with its prime minister, and reminds us that his grandson is a Jew, he will always be a bad swineherd who reveres only power, money, and glitz and could not care less about the miracles, the call to study and intelligence that are the proper genius of Judaism.
My dear, I tell you two or three very evident things. Number one, he should leave alone his Jewish grandsons. Okay? Number two, there is a quote in Hebrew. There is not only proofs of love. There is a deep love which is called Ahavat Israel. You can make gestures toward the Jewish people, like the embassy and so on, if it is not based on a deep love, of a deep understanding of what Israel means, these gestures are zero. Number three, the strength of the Jews in America, which is weakened, by the way, these days by Mrs. Ilhan Omar and all the move around her and so on. There is something happening. The strength of the Jews stands on the fact that they were always very wisely bipartisan. There is something in this embracement of the Jews of America by President Trump that looks like a kiss of death. I hope I'm wrong. Not death, because the Jews are undiable. But I don't like this kiss. Because the Jewish people has survived because of its knowledge, because of its taste for study. And all this ethics of the Jews is 101% opposed to the style which Trump and his entourage embody. And if we do any compromise with this nihilist style, I think we Jews, you American Jews, make a very dangerous mistake.
That is Bernard-Henri Lévy, a philosopher, a filmmaker, and author. His new book is called The Empire and the Five Kings, America's Abdication and the Fate of the World. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And we've got an excerpt from the book at hereandnow.org, and we'd love to hear from you. Lots to discuss.
This message comes from Here and Now sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
We're learning more details about the messy feud between the National Enquirer and Amazon CEO Jeff Bezos, who also owns the Washington Post. The Wall Street Journal reports the publisher of the Enquirer, American Media Inc., paid $200,000 for the rights to sexually explicit texts and pictures that Bezos had sent to a woman he was having an affair with. Now, that payment, according to the Journal, went to the woman's brother, Michael Sanchez. Let's bring in Ali Velshi, MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent. And Ali, what do you think of all this? It's more than just a story of a supermarket tabloid paying a lot of money for some racy pictures.
Well, it's remarkably interesting because of the players, right? We've learned in the last couple of years that the publisher of the National Enquirer, American Media, very tight with Donald Trump, pays for stories that sometimes they kill, sometimes they run, and sometimes there are political motivations. On the other side, we know that Jeff Bezos has been identified by President Trump as somebody who is politically motivated to go after him. And then you've got this guy, the brother of the guy that Jeff Bezos was, the woman that Jeff Bezos was having a relationship with, releasing these texts. Now, Jeff Bezos had said, he had put out in a blog that he thought this was politically motivated. It may have had to do with Saudi investors and all of that. And now it turns out, we don't have all the details yet, that it might have been Lauren Sanchez's brother, Michael, who is a Trump supporter, by the way, who may have handed these texts and pictures over to American media.
Does the Journal seem to be suggesting that Michael Sanchez did just do it for the money? Because as you say, he was a vocal Trump reporter. He was a supporter. He was a talent agent who managed reality show judges. I mean, an interesting guy.
Hard to understand. And the journal stops short of implying one way or the other. So this is a guy, Michael Sanchez, supporter of President Trump. He's actually railed against Bezos in the past. He's got a lot in common politically with David Pecker, the publisher of American Media. So it's not clear what the motivation was. On one hand, $200,000 is ample motivation to do these kinds of things. If it dovetails with political motivation, that might be the case. But the journal isn't reporting on that at the moment. We haven't got a statement from Sanchez to tell us, you know, whether he did this and why he did.
Okay, the president weighed in on all of this earlier in the year. Here's a tweet from him. So sorry to hear the news about Jeff Bozo being taken down by a competitor whose reporting is far more accurate than the reporting in his lobbyist newspaper, referring there to the Washington Post. Mm-hmm. But again, remind us of Pecker's very close relationship to Donald Trump, including the fact that he paid a woman to kill her story about an affair she had with Trump.
Right. So these guys have known each other for more than 20 years, and federal prosecutors in New York allege that Mr. Pecker, in August of 2015, told Donald Trump he would use his publication to help Donald Trump in his presidential campaign, and this is all wrapped up in the hush money payments, right? The publisher reached a non-prosecution agreement with the U.S. Attorney's Office admitting that it paid $150,000 in 2016 to a former Playboy model to suppress her story that she claimed she had an affair with Donald Trump a decade earlier. That's called catch and kill. You catch the story and then you kill it. So Pecker is cooperating with the government on this, and that's why that tweet by Donald Trump was interesting, because you know, the questions are, does anything David Pecker has to do with Donald Trump, is it political?
A story with a lot of tentacles reaching very far, it seems. All right, Ali Velshi, MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent, thanks very much as always.
Oh, my pleasure.
Boeing's CEO has sent an open letter to airlines and passengers saying the company is taking action to ensure the safety of the 737 MAX jet. The response comes as Ethiopia's transport minister said flight data recorders show clear similarities between the Ethiopian Airlines flight that crashed this month and the Lion Air flight that crashed last October in Indonesia. Both were Boeing 737 MAX jets. The planes have been grounded around the world, and the Justice Department is looking into how Boeing is regulated by the Federal Aviation Administration. John Ostrower is editor-in-chief at Air Current. He joins us from Seattle. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
And first of all, just what do you make of the news that officials are now saying that there is a similarity in what went wrong in these two crashes?
Well, clearly this is a further advancement in terms of understanding what happened to both flights. I mean, it is a major escalation, obviously, in terms of the direct technical link. Certainly, as this unfolds, we're going to learn more about what happened to the flight in Ethiopia and its apparent technical connection to what happened in Indonesia back in October. The bigger issue, of course, is about the aircraft as a whole. And we see Congress getting involved. We see potentially the Justice Department getting involved with understanding how the airplane was certified and that process and ultimately what it means for this airplane as the future for Boeing and also for the safe, ongoing continuous operations of global air travel.
Well, when you talk about how the plane was certified, one of the things that's come up in the Wall Street Journal has been reporting on this is that perhaps Boeing had a little too much power in Washington and that the certification process was more about Boeing saying that the plane was okay than the FAA saying that the plane was okay. Is that your sense?
Well, certainly that's the overall contention here, that as questions around the process of actually bringing this airplane to market have grown, and how the various systems, like the one in question, the MCAS system that helps prevent a stall of the airplane, were developed, there are increasing questions around the pressure and the relationship between the FAA and Boeing and how the airplane and the system was actually developed. Back when the 787 was grounded back in January of 2013, there were a lot of these same questions about the relationship between Boeing and the FAA. Boeing and the FAA did a top-to-bottom review of the certification of the 787 Dreamliner in what they came to was that, yes, the airplane was designed was sound, it was safe, but there had been areas in terms of coordination, in terms of oversight, where both could have done significantly better to really make sure that the process for developing these incredibly complex, advanced machines could be significantly better and a greater level of accountability in both directions.
And it looks like at the heart of the problem, if it is in fact a software problem, it involves the anti-stall system. And the reason that that's there, correct me if I'm wrong, is that the plane has bigger engines than other 737s. And so it needed this anti-stall system, Boeing thought, in order to make sure that everything went smoothly.
That's correct. It's worth noting that the use of this MCAS system that we've been talking about so much over the last several months, it really is for a very particular corner of the performance, quote-unquote, envelope operating regime of the airplane. So it's when the flaps are up at high speed and the nose of the airplane is high. It was largely considered to be a very infrequently occurring place for pilots to be flying the airplane. But ultimately, what has happened is we now see these two cases where the system was malfunctioning because bad data was being fed to it. You correctly note that the larger engines that were needed for increased fuel efficiency on the airplane changed the performance handling of the airplane just enough to require the system. And this was Boeing's solution to that. Again, you know, this is an airplane that has been updated and updated and updated over decades. And as, you know, a combination of parts of the airplane have been grandfathered under earlier certification requirements, there has been a constant push and pull of the design over time that, if you're not careful, can create unintended consequences. And certainly what we've seen in the last several months with these two tragic events is that this is potentially one of the unintended consequences of that pressure.
And do you think that the result is going to be just something like a software update for the 737 MAX, or is there something fundamentally wrong with the design of this plane?
Well, I think that is yet to be seen one way or another. I think that the seriousness of the situation really warrants not only just a technical solution to making sure that the system operates safely from here on out, but really ultimately broader steps that I don't think we even know or have seen yet in terms of restoring trust in the reputation of the aircraft. Because, you know, a lot of this is not just just making sure that the pilots and regulators feel safe. It's also about the flying public willing to set foot on the airplane and feel like they can go back to not caring about what airplane they're flying on. So it's not just the software. There certainly are bigger questions that are going to have to be answered by the FAA, by Boeing, and also ultimately when the relations with airlines and the flying public, but how everyone moves forward with making sure that this airplane continues to be the backbone of future air travel.
Well, and let's back up while we have you and talk about that. How did this plane become so important for Boeing? You write about the fact that it was sort of hatched in the Admirals Club at Dallas-Fort Worth International Airport in 2011.
So after the global financial crisis, there was a big push for airlines wanting increased fuel efficiency, but ultimately they didn't really want to pay for it. They didn't want Boeing and Airbus to go do all new airplanes. And what had become available was a new generation of fuel-efficient engines. And Airbus, at the end of 2010, decided that they were going to put new engines on their single-aisle airplane. And ultimately, Airbus ran away with the market. They had tremendous, tremendous success. Mm. They had about an 1,000-order lead over Boeing before Boeing decided to launch the 737 MAX. Boeing wanted to do an all-new airplane. They were would have been ready right about now to next year. But at the time, there were so many huge constraints. They had not finished the 787 yet, which was billions and years behind budget. And the production system required to ramp up to tremendous, tremendous rates to get airplanes to airlines fast enough just didn't exist at the time. So what they decided to do was, okay, we're just going to, you know, develop the MAX. And that decision was really made for them when American Airlines in mid-2011 decided to buy a significant crop of Boeing and Airbus airplanes, 460 airplanes. Hmm. Most of those were Airbus. So it was a huge hit strategically for Boeing to have to share the market, share American Airlines with Airbus.
And what is all of the trouble with the MAX meant for Airbus?
It's not clear yet. Certainly, the A320 has continued to do very well. Certainly, in the background of all of this, I think it's worth noting, is that there has been a persistent increasing downturn in global air travel. The rate of growth has been slowing. Airlines are adding more airplanes and more seats than there is demand. And so, broadly speaking, all of this comes against that backdrop where airlines are actually struggling more to continue the momentum that they've had. So really, as we head deeper into 2019 and put the context of this MAX grounding against that, it really becomes a question of whether or not the grounding of the MAX will give a lot of airlines who had purchased too many airplanes to pull back on their plans. Hmm. And so it's really this combination of factors all kind of swirling together in a perfect storm. We don't know how this ends. However, we do know that the overall macro picture is making a lot of folks in this industry queasy.
And you write that this crisis with the 737 MAX jets could threaten Boeing's very existence.
The 737 is Boeing's bread and butter. It is a marvel of lean manufacturing. It's that process improvement that allowed the airplane to contribute so significantly to its financial success. And that financial success pays for everything from, you know, developing new airplanes to just financing the operations of the company, making sure that shareholders continue to be happy. And so in all of those pieces, you can't divorce the 737 from that. It is the backbone of Boeing. And there are serious, serious questions about what Boeing would look like without the 737.
That is John Ostrower, who is editor-in-chief of the Air Current. John, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Australian Prime Minister Scott Morrison is calling for global social media restrictions following the deadly attacks in New Zealand, which the accused shooter live-streamed on Facebook. Morrison wants world leaders to take up measures at an upcoming G20 summit in Japan this June, saying it is unacceptable to treat the internet as an ungoverned space. Let's bring in Recode, our weekly guide to the world of tech. Peter Kafka is executive editor at Recode. And Peter, Australia's prime minister is calling for better safeguards so that social media platforms can't be exploited by terrorists. Can it be done?
I think practically that's impossible. Look, individual countries regulate the internet all the time. Generally, we hear about repressive regimes. Iran takes down stuff it doesn't like. Saudi Arabia tells Netflix to take down an episode of a show it doesn't like. Individual countries can basically force individual internet companies to behave any way they want. China often does that. The likelihood that you're going to have a bunch of countries coming together with a sort of binding resolution about how an internet company should behave seems very unlikely to me.
How much responsibility do users themselves have? Facebook said late yesterday that 12 minutes after the 17-minute live stream ended, it was only then that a user reported the video to Facebook, which seems like an incredibly long amount of time.
This is the actual problem with Facebook and also Twitter and YouTube and any other platform like this that is designed to be sort of a back and forth between the tech company that owns the platform and the users that supply the content. They're all designed specifically so the users are the ones sort of inputting the content and the platforms can lay back and say, hey, we didn't put that there. Someone else put it there. And someone else needs to tell us it's objectionable and we're not going to react until someone tells us otherwise. So Facebook could blame a user. I don't think they would actually say that. But they've set up a system where they said, look, someone else put this stuff on this thing. We just happen to own the thing, but we didn't put it there. It's not our fault.
And that protects them. That gives them cover.
Literally, it gives them legal protection. There's an entire business reason for that. It's much easier to run a giant internet scale business when it's computers and users putting stuff on the site instead of individuals. And by the way, up until at least recently, there was a big ethos in Silicon Valley that said this is the right way to run something. people who use the software, plus the software should be the ones figuring out how it works, not, you know, a government regulator or a New York media company is sort of a famous epithet. I think now they're starting to rethink some of that, or at least they're not saying that as much out loud. But they, you know, Mark Zuckerberg, a year after the Russia hack, said, look, we, you know, freedom means not having to ask permission for what you put on, you say online, and we're not going to stop you from putting up what you want to put up online. Afterwards, there might be consequences, and that, I think, is still what Facebook believes.
Your colleague Kurt Wagner told me on Friday, and this was shortly after the news broke, that Facebook struggled to contain the footage of the shooting from spreading because it was happening live. Now the company says it's spending a lot of money to address that issue. But what technology is there to better monitor or take down a live broadcast?
Well, if you wanted it to not happen live, you would not build a tool that allows anyone to put up whatever they want live. Once there's video or any other content on the internet and on various social sites, there are ways to use both computers and humans to track that stuff down. It's a giant whack-a-mole game, really at an enormous scale. Even then, it is very hard for very smart people in Silicon Valley to figure out how to stop this just wave of stuff. But if you don't want someone to post something live, don't give them a tool that says post whatever you want live. The best way to do that would be to either take down the tool or at least have some kind of buffer that says you can stream this, you can start recording this stuff live, but we're not going to post it until it's past some sort of minimal threshold of decency.
Sure. And Facebook also says it's moving away from the public news feed and toward the more personal encrypted sharing model, which is totally upends in some ways its business model. But do you think something like that could slow down viral content?
I think slowing down virality is now sort of a thing that Facebook's trying to do, although they tried to encourage it for many years. By the way, they're not moving. They're not going to leave the public news feed. They're just going to say, look, if you want to do more private messaging, that's fine. They're also saying this private messaging is going to be encrypted, so we literally won't know what you're telling other people. Which makes actually enforcing this sort of stuff much, much harder. You could detect patterns and clusters and behaviors, but you wouldn't actually know that someone's sending a horrific video to somebody else. You'd say, I've got no idea what's in there. So it would make it even harder to enforce, which is why one of the reasons this move is controversial both in and outside of Facebook.
Is all of this yet another threat to Facebook's future?
I don't know if it's a threat to Facebook's future. I mean, it's definitely a threat for society to grapple with and for internet companies to grapple with. You know, I think many of us, and myself included, are still sort of thinking about these things as sort of novelties and fun things that might sort of change the way humans communicate, but generally for the better. And over the last few years, we're getting a sense of like, oh no, these things can be terrible tools used by terrible people. And we haven't really figured out the best way to grapple with it, which is why you hear calls for government enforcement.
That's Peter Kafka, executive editor at Recode. Thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.